The next case is 05290, Joe Hickson versus Leslie R. Callentine. Mr. Tamakis.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Steve Tamakis, and I'm here on behalf of Joe Hickson. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time, if I may, for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would be remiss if I didn't begin my argument today by saying the words, this is not a Gelatus case. It's a recurrent theme throughout my brief, and I truly, truly believe that an examination of Gelatus in comparison with the facts and circumstances of this particular case would indicate that that's exactly the fact. The Gelatus court came out with its decision based upon an interpretation of who is an insured. There was an ambiguity in Gelatus. It stemmed from the fact that coverage was requested by virtue of Scott Ponzer, that the employee in that case had derivative coverage by virtue of the word you. That's not what happened here. Joe Hickson is an insured under this contract. There was an endorsement change, and there were actually two endorsement changes within this particular Westport policy that indicate that Mr. Hickson was added as an insured. The first endorsement change is at appendix page 91, and it's entitled Employee as Lessor. Throughout the process of litigation in this particular matter, there were requests for admissions that were submitted to the appellees. One of the requests for admission was admit that Mr. Hickson is a leased worker. They admitted that. That's at appendix 45. This contract defines leased workers as employees. That's at appendix page 84. This particular endorsement change states, and I'm quoting, while any covered auto described in the schedule is leased to you by one of your employees, who is an insured, and it looks like there should be an is there, is changed to include that employee as an insured. There's a second endorsement change. That endorsement change is on appendix page 120. That endorsement change is captioned hired autos specified as covered autos you own. The appellees have admitted that that endorsement change makes Joe Hickson and insured under the liability portion of this policy. They admitted that. They did not appeal the motion to deem that admission admitted to the appellate court, as noted in the appeals court's decision. Yet now they want to argue that you have to be in a covered auto in order to attain coverage. That just isn't within this policy. I ask you to look at appendix page 120, which was the section that the appellate court utilized for its decision. You will not find the word scope of employment in that phrase. You will not find the terms driving in that phrase. You will not even see the words occupying a covered auto in that phrase. I think the Fourth Appellate District lost its way when it applied Gelatus to this case. In fact, this liability policy covers any auto.
Counsel, you're saying we're talking about the intent of this insurance policy, and you're saying that it was intended. Mr. Hickson was a truck driver, I understand.
Owner-operator, Your Honor, you're correct.
And you're saying that it was the intent of this policy to cover employees while they're operating their own vehicles, in this case a motorcycle, outside of the scope of employment. That's the intent of this policy.
Your Honor, I'll take it a step further. The case law, the black letter law, is clear that the intent of any policy, of any contract, is determined by the four corners of the contract. The intent in this policy was to name Joe Hixon as an insured. They added him as an insured without qualification. The intent was to cover any auto. On page, I believe it's appendix page 65 of the brief, you'll find the declarations page. And next to the declarations page for liability coverage, there's a symbol 61. 61 is titled any auto as being the subject of coverage. Auto is defined by this policy as any motorized vehicle. If you ask me the question, did they intend to cover Joe Hixon on his motorcycle? The answer is yes. They are the architects of this contract. That's what the written word says. And this court told us in Buckeye versus Lawson that however inequitable or unjust a result is, this court isn't going to invade a contract and start putting terminology into it that just isn't there. Furthermore, I would submit that if there is an exclusion, if this court should find that the language on page or appendix page 120 is considered to be an exclusion, that exclusion cannot carry over into the coverage that was imposed by operational law in this case. I've heard speakers talk about this, and I'm not asking you to give weight to speakers, but coverage by operational law has been described to be a blank piece of paper. If the parties never contemplated coverage, as far as UM coverage goes, pursuant to 3937.18, how can exclusions within a liability portion of a policy bargain for exclusions be carried over to coverage that was never contemplated? Westport did not comply with Linko. Westport did not comply with Schumacher. And that is the most interesting factor to me. Westport talked throughout its briefs about how this case was improvidently allowed and also raised the idea that Hallen may have some application. I'm asking you to look at appendix page 120, which is the offer sheet that they say they submitted. It's undated. Schumacher says that Westport had an obligation to show that it made a valid offer pursuant to the statute prior to the inception of the policy. It didn't do that, and they admit that they didn't do it. They admit that they didn't comply with Linko. They admit that they didn't comply with Schumacher. They admit that Joe Hixon isn't insured.
Counsel, don't they admit that he's an insured for the purposes of driving his rig?
Never, Your Honor. That was in the appellee's brief, and I was absolutely stunned by that statement. Your Honor, I wrote down the actual admission, and it's at appendix page 44, that pursuant to the endorsement change, Joe Hixon isn't insured under the liability portion of the coverage of the Westport policy effective 11100 through 11101. Your Honor, in order for them to claim that he was not an insured, if they were going to say today, and I assume that this is their position, although I'm still not entirely clear, if they are to claim that Joe Hixon really isn't an insured because he wasn't in his covered auto, how in the world could they have made that admission? How could they say that Joe Hixon isn't insured under the liability portion of the policy? I read that particular phrase at the bottom of that page to mean that as long as Joe Hixon leases or rents his vehicle to Iddings Trucking Incorporated, he's an insured, but only for that vehicle. In other words, he's only insured for as long as that particular vehicle is rented to Iddings Trucking Incorporated. But we don't even need to go there, because as an employee, he was added as an insured under the appendix page 91, employee as a lessor. Your Honors, I would submit that the Fourth District Court of Appeals basically inverted the logic that was handed down by Gelatus. This court told us in Gelatus that we look to ambiguity. If there's an ambiguity, then we're going to determine the intent. We're going to construe this policy in favor of the policyholder and find in that particular situation that they never intended to insure this employee. Here, the court found ambiguity and then went to, found intent and then went to ambiguity. It was reverse logic that was used in the Fourth District's opinion. Your Honors, I'd ask you to follow the Mason case, which is why we're here. This matter was certified to this court pursuant to the Mason versus Royal Insurance case. Mason held that exclusions cannot be carried over to coverage by operation of law. In Mason, there was actually a statement or an exclusion within a policy that said, we are not going to cover vehicles with less than four wheels. And the Fifth District Court of Appeals found that that exclusion could not be carried over to the coverage by operational law. I ask you to follow that logic. I believe the Fourth District Court of Appeals lost its way when it started using Gelatus essentially as a crutch in this particular case to uphold its rationale. This isn't a Gelatus case, and this isn't a Scott Ponser case. I think, and maybe I'm telling tales out of school, but I think it's the truth. Trial courts throughout this state were inundated with Ponser cases when they came in. And Gelatus was almost a safe haven. And I think that trial courts pretty much jumped too abruptly onto Gelatus in denying cases and dismissing cases. And I think that's what happened here.
Counsel, your argument that you've advanced so far presumes that you've been persuasive in saying that this policy did not comport with the requirements of Linco.
That's right, Your Honor.
And you've laid those out in your brief. If it did comport with Linco, then where are you? Are you done?
No, Your Honor, and I think that really just goes back to Schumacher all over again. This court told us in Schumacher that its offer and its acceptance. Linco talks about the offer clearly, but the insurance company has a responsibility as well to prove that there was a rejection, a timely rejection. They didn't do that. The document that they attach as appendix page 120 is undated. Moreover, the request for admissions submitted to Westport ask, isn't it true that you have nothing that shows that this document was submitted prior to the coverage period, November of 00? They admit that. They have not complied with Schumacher on the rejection end, and they have not complied with Linco on the offer end. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Tamakis. Mr. Lester.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'm David Lester, and I'm here this morning representing Westport Insurance Company. There are three ways to determine whether Mr. Hixon is an insured under Westport's policy in this case, and he is not an insured under any of those three ways. The first way is to look to the policy's uninsured motorist endorsement. This court made it clear in the Gelatus case that the party's intent is paramount. This court held in the Holloman case that nothing in the uninsured motorist statute precludes an insurance company from defining who is an insured under its policy. In this case, Iddings Trucking and Westport Insurance Company intended to include uninsured motorist coverage in this policy in the amount of $25,000. Uninsured motorist coverage does not arise by operation of law under this policy.
Well, you would agree that when this policy was entered into, Lenko was the law of the state, would you not?
Actually, Lenko was decided in December of 2000. This policy was entered into in November of 2000. Nonetheless, Lenko does apply to the policy. Right. I don't dispute that. But you raise an important point, Your Honor, and that relates to did we comply with Lenko or did we not? If you look at this reduction form, the offer and reduction form, on its face, it doesn't include a premium quote. So on its face, it doesn't comply with Lenko. But in the Holland case, this court held that the four corners of that form do not control, and that extrinsic evidence is admissible to show compliance with Lenko. That determination has never been made in this case.
It also doesn't show a date.
It doesn't show a date, but there is uncontradicted evidence in the record, Your Honor, that that form was mailed back to Westport by November 22nd of 2000. That was long before the accident in this case, which was in July of 2001. Under the applicable version of the uninsured motorist statute, that form is effective when signed. This is not subject to Ghiori. This is a later version of the statute. There was an affidavit submitted by the president of Iddings Trucking that says just that. This policy includes an express uninsured motorist coverage endorsement. That endorsement is intended to govern the policy's uninsured motorist coverage. Even the Fifth District, which had held in the Rohr case that where you have an express uninsured motorist form, but the limit of liability is increased by operation of law. In Rohr, they held, well, this is coverage by operation of law. We can just ignore the endorsement. They've retreated from that position. They did that in the Hanna versus Liberty case, and even the Fifth District now recognizes that if you have an express uninsured motorist endorsement, that endorsement controls. This is not a case like Dimitri versus Kim. In Dimitri, it was a general liability policy. There was no uninsured motorist coverage endorsement at all. And the court said, well, there were no terms and conditions that were negotiated. Therefore, an exclusion in the liability part of the policy doesn't apply. The court at the same time, citing this court's decision in the Duryak versus Globe case, recognized that fundamental conditions to coverage still apply. This uninsured motorist endorsement was drafted after Scott Ponser. It was drafted in response to Scott Ponser to draft around that case. Only a person occupying a covered auto is an insured under this UM endorsement. For purposes of uninsured motorist coverage, only autos owned or leased by Iddings Trucking are covered autos for uninsured motorist coverage. That provision makes it clear that the parties intended to limit uninsured motorist coverage to accidents that were related to Iddings' business. Mr. Hickson's motorcycle is not included. Every court that has considered this endorsement, and there are a number of them, both trial and appellate courts, have upheld it and said that that definition of insured is valid and enforceable. The only thing in this case that could possibly happen by operation of law is that the limit of liability for uninsured motorist coverage could be increased from the $25,000 stated in the policy up to the regular liability limit of $1 million.
Mr. Lester, the argument of Mr. Tamakis is, I think, that there's an admission with respect to the fact that this individual isn't insured.
Well, I think
is that probative here?
No. I think that Mr. Tamakis overstates what that admission is. And when he quoted the admission, he left out an important phrase. The admission specifically refers to the endorsement entitled Hired Autos Specified as Covered Autos You Own. And under that endorsement,
Your view is this: the vehicle that was being operated, the motorcycle, is not a covered auto under the policy at issue. Therefore, he's not insured under that policy.
That's correct, under the UM endorsement. But even the admission simply admitted that Mr. Hickson was an insured for liability coverage in accordance with that endorsement. That endorsement says he's only insured while that truck, his leased vehicle, is being operated by or for Iddings Trucking.
Okay.
There was no – this admission is a red herring. It doesn't resolve the issue here.
Okay. Now, I think you've addressed us or urged us to consider an improvident allowance in this case. But is there some law that might be relevant on either or both of those issues then to be written? Or do you think this case is controlled by one case or another?
I think that this case is different than some of the cases that have come before – factually, and that there is no case out of this court that addresses the issue of what happens, what terms govern uninsured motorist coverage if you have an express endorsement, but if the limit is increased by operation of law. Now that in a sense is putting the cart before the horse, because there's been no finding that there hasn't been a compliance with Linco. Is there an admission that there's no premium quote in the form? Sure. You can look at the form and anybody would agree with that. But that doesn't mean no Linco compliance in light of the Holland case, where we're entitled to consider extrinsic evidence, and that determination was never made. The plaintiff's argument that the court should simply ignore an express uninsured motorist endorsement, which is undeniably a part of this policy, would lead to an absurd result. Suppose, for example, that Westport Insurance Company decided that it was not going to issue an auto liability policy that didn't include uninsured motorist coverage. It doesn't allow rejection, so it never makes an offer. It just says, here it is, take it or leave it. If you don't want uninsured motorist coverage, then go somewhere else for your insurance. Under the plaintiff's view, since there was no offer compliant with Linco, we could simply ignore the uninsured motorist endorsement and pretend it didn't exist, and we'd be writing on a clean slate.
Well, counsel, that's an academic discussion of something that's passed now, isn't it? I mean, that if that kind of policy were offered today, it wouldn't matter.
I'm not sure I follow you, Your Honor.
Well, the law has changed. There's no requirement for offering. So, I mean, you're setting up a straw man that wouldn't matter today. It would matter to a small subset of cases that are now history.
It's a logical extension, though, of the argument that the plaintiff is making in this case, where they say, well, we have this endorsement here, but there's no compliance with Linco, so we're going to ignore the endorsement and pretend it's not there. But you also raise...
Oh, isn't that what you would do if you don't comply with Linco? You don't have an endorsement.
There's two scenarios, Your Honor. One is where you have a reduction in coverage, and therefore the policy includes an express uninsured motorist endorsement, but the limit is increased by operation of law. That's what we have here. But there are terms and conditions in the policy that the parties agreed to for uninsured motorist coverage, and those terms still apply whether the limit is $25,000 or $100,000 or $1 million. That's different from a rejection of uninsured motorist coverage where there's no endorsement at all and therefore no terms and conditions. In that case, the statute presumably applies the terms and conditions, save who is an insured, where you would still look at the insurance policy. But your point raises another matter that we've addressed in the brief, and that is that this appeal really ought to be dismissed as improvidently allowed, and the reason you point out is one of them. There hasn't been a requirement to offer uninsured motorist coverage by operation of law since Senate Bill 97 took effect in October of 2001, almost 4 years ago. Operation of law coverage doesn't exist anymore. Discussions of coverage by uninsured motorist coverage by operation of law are academic. They're of little consequence
but
to anybody.
Isn't this a certified conflict case, so how could we improvidently allow it? We would have to find that a conflict doesn't exist.
That may be right, Your Honor. That may be right.
Because we didn't take in the jurisdictional case.
I realize that. But I believe that even in certified conflict cases, this court has dismissed them as improvidently allowed. I think that that has occurred in the past, and I think it could happen here. If you apply the terms
Let me ask you to follow up. That is there a conflict between the 4th and the 5th District here or not?
Well, in part, there's a conflict, Your Honor. Mason is like this case. There was a reduced uninsured motorist limit, so there was a UM form on the policy.
Mm-hmm.
Mason said, we're not going to look at that form. Now, by the way, the 5th has retreated from that in Hanna versus Liberty. They don't say that anymore, but in Mason they said that. But what they then did was they looked to the liability side of the policy to determine who is an insured. And in that, and on the first part of it where they ignored the uninsured motorist endorsement, that's different from what the 4th District did here. The 4th District also said, though, in this case, by the way, if you look at the liability side of the policy, it's the same result. In Mason, the 5th District did just that. They looked at the liability side of the policy. Now, they came to a different result because Mason involved a personal lines policy, where Dan Mason was the named insured under this. Well, it wasn't a corporate policy. Dan Mason was the insured. His son was a family member who lived with him, so he fell within the definition of insured in that policy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have a different result here. By the way, I should point out that this court 35 years ago in the Abate versus Pioneer Mutual case addressed a situation similar to this. Abate involved a policy that had, like most policies, a preprinted form. That form included express uninsured motorist terms and conditions, but the insured didn't buy uninsured motorist coverage. But since there was no offer, this court said, well, it arises by operation of law. We're going to apply those terms and conditions that are in the policy.
Well, now, that's a pretty big stretch, isn't it? I mean,
I think it's the same as this case, Your Honor. There are terms and conditions for uninsured motorist coverage. Now, here, this is even a stronger.
You didn't offer the coverage. It isn't in the policy, but we're going to apply language that was never offered and was never included in the policy.
It was this court's holding, Your Honor. Abate versus Pioneer.
That might meet the Gladys test for wrongly decided, mightn't it?
If you apply the terms of the uninsured motorist endorsement here, only somebody occupying a covered auto is an insured. Mr. Hickson wasn't occupying a covered auto. If you're not going to apply the UM endorsement, then you should apply the liability side of the policy. And Mr. Hickson is not an insured there either. There's this hired auto endorsement. It says Mr. Hickson is an insured while he's driving his vehicle in Itting's trucking's business. That didn't happen. If you look at the main definition of insured in the policy, the who is an insured provision, it says you for any covered auto. Covered autos, there's a serious factual mistake here that the plaintiff is making. He says, well, we provide coverage for any auto. Well, first of all, designating any auto for purposes of liability coverage doesn't define who's an insured. It says Itting's Trucking is an insured with respect to accidents involving any auto. Doesn't make Mr. Hickson an insured. But more importantly than that, Mr. Tamakis is right. When you look at the original declarations page, it's got the symbol 61 that means any auto. That declarations page was superseded by endorsement number 3 to this policy. That is at page 117 of the appendix to the plaintiff's brief. That symbol was changed. It was changed to the symbols, and it was changed effective the inception of the policy by endorsement 3. It was changed to the symbols meaning owned autos, hired autos, or non-owned autos used in the business of Itting's Trucking. We do not provide liability coverage for any auto. We provide liability coverage for autos owned and operated for Itting's Trucking. Plaintiff doesn't qualify as an insured if you look at the liability definition of who is an insured. And that, by the way, is what the uninsured motorist statute says to do. It says that if you issue an auto liability policy, you have to offer uninsured motorist coverage to persons insured under the policy. The statute directs that you would look, if there's nothing else, if there's no uninsured motorist endorsement, like we have here, first you would look to the UM endorsement, but if there is none, because there was a rejection rather than a reduction, the uninsured motorist statute says to find out who's an insured, you look at the liability section of the policy, and Mr. Hixon doesn't qualify. The third way that you could determine who...
You need to sum up. Your red light's on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Tamakis, you've saved just about a minute and a half of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice O'Donnell, I'd like to address a question you asked earlier. The answer is yes, there is stare decisis for this particular matter.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
There is stare decisis. There is prior court holdings in this regard. I understand, Scott Ponser anymore in my office has become, in essence, a dirty word to a certain extent, but Scott Ponser applies here. This court in Galatas certainly did limit Ponser, and that's what Syllabus 2 says, that Ponser was limited. But Scott Ponser says that terms and conditions within a liability portion of a policy don't carry over to UM coverage that is imposed by operational law. That was a holding in Ponser. Your Honor, second of all, I'd like to speak to Hallen, if I could. The appellees had a chance at the trial court level to present any and all information regarding that offer. Hallen, the appellate court decision in Hallen was in existence at that time. They didn't present anything in terms of how this offer, what they call an offer, was made or under what circumstances that it was made. Last, Your Honors, I'd like to talk about appendix page 121, or 120, if I might. This is what this document says. While any covered auto described in the schedule is rented or leased to you and is being used by or for you, its owner or anyone else from whom you rent or lease it is an insured, but only for that covered auto. Your Honors, driving is not in that paragraph. And I heard it time and time again from Mr. Lester. Driving is not in that paragraph. That's a term that the appellees want to add to it. It just isn't there.
You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Tamakis. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.